From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2007 when New York State created a complex new school funding formula. The goal in using millions of your tax dollars was to provide a sound and basic education to all students, no matter how wealthy their school district is. But credit where it's due, our colleagues at the USA Today Network's Albany Bureau found some serious structural problems with how that formula works. It's infected by politics. It often relies on outdated statistics. The poverty stats, for example, go back to the 2000 U.S. Census. New York State spends roughly $24 billion a year on its schools. And here's a stat you probably hear often, that's 87% higher than the national average for state spending. But is it equitable? Governor Cuomo's team has said that the formula is more progressive than critics imply, but they acknowledge it needs some updating. Just about every time I talk to a school superintendent, the subject comes up in some fashion, so we decided to sit down and talk about how school funding works and how it doesn't. Let me welcome my guests for the hour. Kimberly Ward is superintendent of the Gates-Chilai Central School District. Kim, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mark Linton is the superintendent of the East Rochester Union Free Central School District. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
And Dave Green is the assistant superintendent for finance and operations at East Rochester. Dave, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
There's a lot of different ways we can take this, but I will just tell our listeners right off the bat here. If you care about your property taxes, if you care about how schools are functioning, if you care about whether it's really equitable for kids, this is the kind of hour that I hope you'll engage with us. If you've got questions on how money is spent and how it's not spent, it's a good time to call the program and we'll try to get those answered for you. I want to start with Kim because before the program began, I just asked, what's top of mind for you? And one of the things that Kim and Dave mentioned right away was foundation aid. Why don't both of you make sure we've got a good definition for our listeners to make sure they know what that means, foundation aid?
Sure. Foundation aid is a form of aid that was designed to level the playing field for educating our students statewide. And that was legislation back in 2007. And unfortunately, the 2008-2009 recession hit. And of course, then the formula couldn't run as it was designed to run. And so, you know, we've been facing many challenges around trying to balance a budget. So we only have three sources of revenue for school districts in order to operate, one of which is school aid, property taxes, and also some federal aid. Some of us, not all of us, get it, and not all of us get a lot of that. So, you know, in the age of recession and now faced with the property tax cap levy limit, we are challenged to balance a budget each and every year. And this year, our advocacy from the superintendent's level is around foundation aid, reformulating the formula, so to speak, and really looking for some answers from our legislators around that work. I do want to start this conversation by saying that our local legislators are very, very supportive of our local schools. And we just had a legislative breakfast where we all come together with many of our school board members, along with superintendents and our local legislators. And the topic of that conversation, for the most part, from that panel conversation was around foundation aid and their willingness to advocate for our school districts.
Okay, so when you think about how schools are funded, as Superintendent Ward just said, there's federal aid that not everybody gets, state aid and local taxes. State aid, foundation aid, to you, synonymous?
Yeah, for the most part. There's other aids. There's three sources of aid. There's also a high-cost aid. There's other categories. But foundation aid is really one that isn't categorized as an aid, and that's the one that we really rely on in hopes of balancing our budgets.
Okay. Pretty good definitions there, Dave. Anything you want to add?
The foundation aid is a major component of state aid, but the others are the categorical aids that Kim describes are expense-driven. So you have to spend the money to get it. Usually in the following year, you get a reimbursement of part of that expenditure.
So if you think about each school district, and again, we've got East Rochester and Gates-Chilai represented here. You know, Kim, when it comes to federal, state aid, and then local taxes, what's the breakdown for how much of your budget is filled by federal aid, how much of your budget is filled by state aid, how much of your budget is filled by local taxes?
Yeah, federal aid is a really small proportion of it. You know, many of our schools are Title I schools, so we do work through some of that. In terms of our property tax, it's probably, I would say, probably half and half at this point.
Half and half in terms of property taxes versus state aid?
State aid.
Okay.
State aid.
East Rochester?
Foundation aid makes up roughly a quarter of our budget. than the rest. So another quarter, if you will, would be expense-driven aids. And then tax levy would be pretty much the other half.
All right. So, again, it's about 50% tax. Local tax is 50%, state aid in some form. And when we mentioned right off the top, this is a formula that is starting to feel outdated for a lot of districts. Kim's eyes just went wide. Here's an example of why. If you use the 2000 census to help create the formula for how many families are in poverty, how many kids are in poverty for your district, and how much does that impact your funding? Here's an example with Gates Chilai. You have to use the 2000 census still, is that correct?
Yes, there's some formulas. We just had a meeting with Questar, and they're telling us that the governor now is proposing to look at the 2012-2013 numbers, which is somewhat promising. But again, there's not a lot of answers. We really can't wrap our arms around that because the information is just a lot of assumptions at this point.
Okay, so if you use the 2000 census, like districts have had to do, how many people were in poverty? How many households in poverty in 2000?
Just about 7 years ago, we were at 29% free and reduced lunch. Right now, we're at about 52% district-wide. I have an elementary school that's up as high as 65%.
So from 29% to 52%, and if you're using 29% as a baseline for your funding, how much does that hurt you in terms of what you can get?
Oh, it's huge in terms of recognizing, one, our poverty levels, because there's a lot of things that go along with that. And, you know, we have to have that conversation around our student population that is made up of students with disabilities, but also our English language learners. Our numbers are increasing in terms of the number of families that are coming into the Rochester area and coming to school in Gates Chilai. And right now, there's some mandates coming from the state. Now, some of it is financially supported, but we have to have a certain proportion of instructors to students for that. And so we're adding more staff. And again, when you're adding more staff, you're adding more salary and benefits, which for us makes up about, you know, 65% of our total budget. And then the other 10% is about debt service. And so it's a real struggle when you think about the many things that are changing demographically throughout our communities that are really impacting how we balance a budget.
All right, Superintendent Linton mentioned something before the hour began as well that I want to touch on, and that's the fact that sometimes we get bogged down just focusing on per pupil spending, and that may not be everything. In Joe Spector's reporting for Gannett on this issue last fall, he pointed out that there are some New York school districts that spend $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 total per pupil, and there are some districts, generally poorer districts, that spend $11,000, $15,000, $20,000, everything combined. That's a huge disparity. Should we be comfortable that that's just the reality, that's just how it works, Mark?
No, I don't think we should be comfortable with that. I think looking at foundation aid in isolation of other factors is a mistake. You know, it's one aspect of a bigger picture. And one of the questions about per pupil spending is you're basically taking your student population and dividing it by your number of employees. That's all employees, not just faculty members or classroom teachers. So one of the districts downstate that I think Joe Spector was referring to, which has the highest per pupil expenditure, only has 115 students.
Okay, sure.
And so when you divide 115 students by whatever staff members, you're going to get a higher per pupil cost. So it can be a little misleading. Now, that's not to say that one of the questions or debates around the foundation aid is not the money itself, it's how it's distributed. And I think when the foundation aid formula was originally created, it was supposed to be distributed in a way that supported low wealth or basic average wealth school districts. And it hasn't been distributed that way because a component of the foundation aid formula is politics. So if you're connected politically or you have political clout, then your districts will get more money funded.
And this has been shown, by the way. What Mark's saying is not just denying that theory, right? I mean, Joe Spector report on this. Politics is a part of how schools are funded.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in our New York State Senate, 26 of the senators are from downstate. All other upstate portions are represented by 22 senators. So it becomes inequitable. It is a political game. I was told that by a former superintendent. That's, make sure you're advocating for foundation aid because it's a political piece to it.
Okay. And so, Mark, I know given the fact that you not only have been superintendent at East Rochester, but you spent a couple of decades in Avon, is that right?
Geneseo.
Oh, Geneseo. And, you know, there's probably plenty of conservative parents and conservative community members there. You've got a lot of people who are want to make sure tax dollars are spent. Well, everybody. It's not just conservatives who want to make sure our money is spent wisely, to be fair. So, but I'm sure you hear that all the time, that, well, don't we spend enough on schools? Doesn't New York State spend enough on schools? New York State spends more than 87% more than the national average state on schools. So I guess the question in play here is how to create a more equitable system. You're talking about taking politics out. That's one component. Mm-hmm. But if you were starting from scratch, what would you do?
Well, first I'd rely on common sense. If you were just go to different schools, you would see the inequities. If you were to go to low-wealth school districts and then higher-wealth districts, you would see the inequities. As Kim was referring to, in a lower-wealth district, you are more likely to have more students with special needs, which are mandated services, academic intervention services, special education, and potentially more students who receive English as a second language, which are mandated. And so you are now spending in areas that are required. So your flexibility for where you cut becomes diminished. And if you go to a higher wealth district, they may have more AP classes, more opportunities for students that are non-mandated. And so when they have to make a cut with their budget, it may be something that's not as required that impacts fewer students. Back to your question in terms of the formula or where to start, right now the foundation aid formula has a range in terms of what it uses for wealth. And so the lowest wealth that a district can be is 0.65 based on its wealth index that the state has. There are 300 school districts that have a wealth ratio lower than 0.65, but they all get treated as 0.65. The high range is 2.0. So all districts in New York State are treated as 2.0 for a wealth index. There are no schools in Monroe County, so think of our wealthiest schools, that are 2.0. So the formula is run between this very strict range. And so low-wealth schools that are below 0.65 are treated the same as 0.65 schools, and their wealth is much lower. So the formula needs to be targeted.
Why do they do it that way? I froze you.
Yeah, well,
you don't have a good answer, do you?
I did have an answer.
Oh, you do?
I had not a good answer. I had an answer.
Oh, but, did you have a snarky answer?
No, it's just, well, I think politics and education are not a good mix.
Okay. Okay. Kim, did you want to fill in an answer for that?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of us out there that have really questioned how the formula is calculated. And, you know, like I said, it just came from the Questar workshop last week. And, you know, there's a lot of what ifs. You know, you look at the current formula. Governor Cuomo does have some thoughts about reformulating how that's calculated, which we'll be anxious to see. But, you know, right now, I think going back to some of the things that Mark talked about, and that's some of what my concern is, you know, they're looking at $16 billion in foundation aid, but they're looking at a $428 million increase, which is below what the foundation aid increase was the year before. But the issue is that GEA and the restoration of GEA carried us. And so this year, we don't have the GEA restoration. And you know, thankfully, they restored it. And, you know, it really helped us balance our budget last year. But again, many of us are looking at a property tax cap levy limit that is zero or below, which really challenges us. And now, with the foundation aid being less of an increase than the year before, and now the GEA, we can't rely on that, you know, that is of real concern to us. And, you know, I just want to say to our local taxpayers, I don't think any of us in the county or in the region question a 2% cap and wanting to make sure that we're being fiscally responsible to our taxpayers in terms of educating our children, preparing them for college and career readiness. And many of us, and I know our school boards, are very supportive of staying within that 2% or at least keeping those tax increases pretty stable and consistent throughout the years so that we can maintain and sustain those programs that are important for our kids to be successful. So, you know, there's lots of things that I struggle with when we talk foundation.
But it's not a 2% cap, right?
It is not. That's how it was originally.
A lot of listeners, a lot of people assume that that's what the tax cap is. So let me pause for 1 second and say to listeners, I don't mean at all to sort of talk down. I just want to make sure we're all kind of staying with exactly what Kim just said, because there's a lot of alphabet soup in there, and I want to make sure we're all square on what's going on. I think what Kim is saying is foundation aid for an increase of state funding for foundation aid for schools 428 or something
million
like
that? Million is what he's proposing. Yes.
Yeah, is what the governor's proposing this year, which would be a smaller increase than last year. But last year came with a kind of a one-shot increase that you got from what she called the GEA, the gap elimination adjustment.
Yes.
You don't have that.
That's
so
correct.
This week your parents say, I'm going to give you a $5 allowance. And you say, well, last week you gave me a $7 allowance and I got a $10 bonus from dad. No bonus. So all of a sudden that's what you're looking at for schools. It's a big difference. And now you're also looking at this formula that might penalize you because you're using outdated poverty numbers. You're using poverty numbers that they might not like the way they're constructed to begin with. That creates kind of an artificial floor. And that's why districts are struggling. I think, are we on the same, is that
you're
correct?
You're spot on.
Okay.
That's very correct. So that,
the only thing I would add to
yes.
that is that the GEA was not a bonus. It was not an addition. It was something that was owed. And so it was
sure.
withheld and then given back. So it was portrayed as, and we're giving you this other money, and it's really not. It's money,
money
that, had
that,
been
that you should have, or at least the law said you should have had over time,
yeah.
going back again to the recession in 2008-2009 that threw a lot off. So that's where things are. Listeners, if you want to jump in with how you feel about how schools spend money, if you have any questions, I'm sure our guests here, what they think are maybe common misperceptions, or would love to engage with you on that, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI, if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. So as we talk about with this proposal of more state aid, the governor always proposes less than the legislature gives, or often. Is that correct? Do you assume that that's what's going to happen?
That is correct. There's a lot of negotiations that occur now, now that they're in session and through the time in which they guarantee that they would have a state budget released by April 1st, which we always look forward to. But, you know, there's lots of assumptions, lots of numbers, lots of folks out there that, you know, provide additional resources. We do have our initial aid runs, which, you know, a lot of people don't understand. We have to build a budget based on those aid runs that are guesstimates in terms of how they're going to end up. And you need to have your boards approve a budget by mid-April, and the actual budget doesn't come out until April 1st. So, you know, oftentimes we're making a lot of assumptions and building a budget based on that information.
Okay. And let me ask Dave Green, the Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Operations at East Rochester, to follow up on the point that I think a lot of people assume that there is right now a 2% tax cap. And it's a little more complex than that. It's often less than 2%, but why?
Because it's based on growth factors that come from the state. It's based on the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. There's also factors within each district that you have to plug into the formula as far as the number of pilots, payments in lieu of taxes agreements that you have, and there's also capital exclusions depending on the reconstruction work that you've had done in your district and the debt service that and the building aid that goes on that goes with that.
All right, so
all these factors, I wish I had an example to show you. You plug these into this formula, and it spits out an increase as your maximum levy limit.
Your maximum. I mean, it would probably take some Ross Perot-like charts to kind of get there eventually, but each district is going to have its number. And what is East Rochester's number, for example?
I believe it's 1.62 right
okay,
now.
So it's not 2%. It's 1.62. If you want to go 1.63 or more, you need a supermajority of votes
That's
to pass
correct.
The budget, right? 60%
yes.
or more. Listeners might remember a couple of years ago, not too many districts tried to pass a supermajority for a larger tax increase beyond the cap. I think Brighton did it a couple of years ago. West Irondequoit tried and failed a couple of years ago. There are a few other districts downstate, but that's asking a lot. And all of a sudden you're on something close to austerity if you don't pass it. So what's Gates Chiali's number?
Yeah, we're just a little under 2. I think last time I looked, it was 1.87.
Okay.
So, I'd just like to let me add this year's cap for East Rochester was 0.12.
0.12?
Yeah.
So it's close to no increase.
Right.
That's what the coming vote in May is going to be?
No.
This is what
we're operating on this year, fiscal year. So I just wanted to illustrate that because it's a lot. This year it was a lot lower.
Okay. So that's not 2%, Superintendent Linton. 2% would have been a lot more money than that.
Yeah, and as Kim had alluded to, our Board of Education and our group that devises the budget is not looking to increase the tax levy. Very often, we're trying to maneuver around what the state has not, or what the state is providing for schools. So I don't think, as Kim had said, our school board and our constituents are not looking to raise taxes. We are just trying to look to function. So there are 11 components to the state tax cap. There are 11 components to it, as Dave had alluded to, and that's it's really a shell game.
Okay.
I need to make a correction.
Sure.
The growth factor this year was 0.12. Our tax levy limit was 0.49. Still makes my point.
Got it. Less than half of 1%.
Right.
Got it. Let me grab our first phone call. We have questions from listeners via Twitter, email, and phone already. Let me grab Melissa in Honeoye Falls. Go ahead, Melissa.
Yes, hi. It doesn't kind of pertain to the areas around us, the public schools, but how are international schooling different from public schools?
How are international schools?
Yeah. Kids that go over and study at international schools, how are those funded and how are those run?
It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer. Does anybody at the table, have you studied how that works?
I think it would depend on which country you're referring to. I know there are some Scandinavian countries where it's everybody pitches in. It's more of a socialist approach to funding education. Families get support as soon as their children are born, and schooling begins in the home at around age 3. So it varies based on the country that you're in.
And the reason why I ask that is my son went to a college with a bunch of students that went to international schools, and he felt that he was undereducated compared to all those children. And I'll just be blunt here. He went out to school here in Honeyeye Falls. And being a former teacher, I was told it was the best-kept secret out here to come out to school here. And my children went away feeling that they were not, you know, as best educated as they could be. And that's in a higher, you know, school district, public school district, you know, with the mean is higher of standard of living out here.
Okay. I don't have anybody from Honeyeye Falls to sort of rebut that, and there's some really good people there.
No, but I'm just
really
generally speaking
there, but,
here,
yeah,
you
sure.
know, more money's out here, yeah. but, you know, the international schools, I've, you know, been told. So
okay.
I was just wondering, you know, with the changes that might be going on with our political getting with our new educator, Voss, coming in.
Betsy DeVos, yes.
Yeah, if how things are going to be run if the government steps in or steps out.
Melissa, thank you. Our panelists were promised no questions on Betsy DeVos. That's not actually true. They did not even ask, but we were going to talk school funding. I will just keep this brief, and I will just ask you, is Betsy DeVos's position as the Secretary of Education now going to impact the way you do business, Mark Linton, in East Rochester?
I think that remains to be seen.
Okay.
I don't really know what's been said and what's been done are yet to be seen. So I couldn't answer that.
Okay. Good dodge, Senator. Mr. Green, what do you think?
I don't know what impact she's going to have. I think over the years, what the Federal Department of Education does as far as funding doesn't really impact us that much. We are somewhat insulated from any reduction in funding. So
the bigger question would be if they get really serious about school choice vouchers, and
that's a pretty heavy lift, in my opinion,
okay.
because education is a state responsibility in the Constitution, not a federal responsibility. So to force New York State to direct tax money to private schools, I don't see how she could do that. There would be a large hue and cry and resistance to that, and I don't think she's going to reach that far.
Okay.
But if she did, it would be, I don't think she would be successful.
Okay. Superintendent Ward?
Yes, I just keep going back to, we have to really rely on our own state legislators to really do what's best for the students and the children of New York State, and that's really where I'm relying my faith and compassion and support of our local government here in the state, and hope to continue to focus on that piece of it.
And I gave Superintendent Linton a hard time. I was kidding. And he's right. I mean, there's a lot of talk about what could be coming with Secretary DeVos, but a lot of the time, talk at a confirmation hearing doesn't always equal practice. So best to wait and see, right? Let me get back to your phone calls. Corey in Mount Morris next. Go ahead, Corey.
Hi. Yes, I was just curious. if you can confirm for me whether or not it's true that a certain percentage of the profits garnered from the New York State Lottery are supposed to be allocated for public schooling.
Mr. Green.
My understanding of how the lottery aid works, the schools don't, schools are at the very end of that that amount of money. They don't receive that amount. I'm messing this up. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
What I want to say is the amount of lottery income that is taken in this state, very little of that winds up in as an aid to public schools.
That's probably not the public perception. Do
no,
you agree
I
with that?
I think it's perceived generally that a lot of maybe even the majority of lottery proceeds go to schools, but they don't. There's very little that winds up in schools' coffers.
Okay. Does that answer your question, Corey?
Well, actually, I agree with the superintendent. I was under the impression that very little actually made it to the public schools, and I was curious as why that's the case, because from what I understood, that's what the proceeds were originally designated for.
Corey, thanks for
the prize.
Yeah, thanks for the phone call. I will let our guest respond to that. I will just add, the government in this country has always had a very interesting relationship with gambling. If they can figure out how to tax it, they generally allow it. If they can't, look at Bill Frist and the Republicans and online poker in 2007. They stop it, or they try to stop it. But they will also tell you often that the lottery is a windfall for schools. So he's sort of indicating, you know, how come, is this a problem? I mean, Superintendent Ward, how much time do you spend thinking about this? Is this an issue to you that we should be exploring?
I don't spend a lot of time, you know, thinking about it, because there's so many other things that we need to be thinking about in terms of keeping our kids safe and ready to come in and learn each day. But I do know that some of that, that profit and proceeds just goes to the state. And then the state, I think, sells it in terms of how they distribute what proceeds come in from lottery, and some of which will go toward education. But we don't see those numbers directly, nor do they come to us directly.
Okay. Mark, you want to add to that?
Nope, Kim and Dave nailed it.
All right. Well, thanks for the phone call, Corey. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're talking to Superintendent Kim Ward from Gates-Chihalai Central School District, Superintendent Mark Linton from East Rochester, and Dave Green, the Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Operations at East Rochester. Let's get our only break of the hour. Celine, Susan, Mark, Alan, we'll get your questions as well coming up here. And we'll take more phone calls if you like as we continue discussing how our schools are funded and what might change, especially if the superintendents kind of get their way and see some, in their eyes, more equitable changes for the way schools are funded. That's all coming up next. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Danny Wegman, Ann Kress from MCC, and Vincent Esposito, representing the governor's office. And we're talking about New York State's Regional Economic Development Councils. Might have seen recently that Bob Duffy and others have praised the Economic Development Council, saying that they've been a success for Rochester and the Finger Lakes, pointing to jobs and growth. We'll talk about that and answer any questions you might have. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I'm going to start with Sarah's email question. She wants to know if New York State is now spending more money on pre-K. Is there more funding for that? She says a few years ago she heard a lot about the push for more pre-K. What's happening? Superintendent Ward?
Yes, that's part of the governor's budget and focusing on UPK programs statewide. I will say that we were one of very few districts regionally that won or were rewarded, can't talk today, with a very competitive grant for UPK programs in our district. And we've been so grateful for that. But we worry, is that funding going to continue? How will they equitably distribute UPK funding throughout the state? And so we have already started to build into our general budget, even though we're continuing to get those grant funds to help support our UPK programs. We need to build it in because we feel it's so important for our early literacy and math skills for our students entering kindergarten. And what I do want to say that a lot of our public don't understand is, believe it or not, kindergarten is a non non-mandated program. So many of our districts in small rural areas are often forced with, if I have to balance the budget, do I look at non-mandated programs, one of which is kindergarten? I don't think any of us want to make that decision, nor have any school districts in the state have made that decision. But again, I focus on UPK is absolutely critical for school success, but we also want to make sure that our legislators and our governor understands and knows that, one, we have to mandate kindergarten and then also mandate those UPK programs that really help many of our high poverty families afford early learning programs that help them be successful in school.
You say UPK, I assume you mean starting at 4, not 3, yes?
Yes, right now we start at 4, but some of the governor's proposals and some of the information we're getting from the state is to include 3- and 4-year-olds in that program.
Should it?
Yes, I believe it should.
And it sounds to me, and tell me if I'm interpreting this correctly, you get this boost for UPK, but you've got to be sure that that's going to be sustained in future budgets. Otherwise, you're spending on a very important program, but not a free one, and all of a sudden in future years that funding's not there. Is that the issue at hand?
Absolutely. We went into the application process saying, can our board support and will our community be able to support this program moving forward? It made no sense for us to apply in hopes of being granted those funds without some sustainability over time. And so our board has been very supportive and committed to that programming.
Okay. And Superintendent Linton, again, without having... I don't have data on international programs and how it works in different countries, but you're right. I mean, we read stories about different educational launches at age 3 and certainly 4 in many Scandinavian countries, different European countries. Should we have more emphasis on starting as early as possible, 3, 4 in this country, than we do now?
I think there's a place for that. I also think it's important for children to be with their families. But I think, you know, starting at age 3, depending on what the program looks like, I think it's a good idea. And especially if parents are involved in that process, because I think a lot of what learning that happens prior to kindergarten happens at home. And so I think if parents can be a part of that process, I think it's important. The other thing related to international schooling is we educate all of our students in the United States. So there are most countries, I won't say all because I don't know, but most countries after elementary school begin sorting students into different lines of education, and we educate all of our students. So I think that's an important component.
Okay, and forgive my ignorance on this, but you know, you're a parent, you start figuring out who's got all-day kindergarten, who's got half-day. Is that all just based on money?
Yep.
Who's offering all-day versus full-day?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yep,
it
has to do with how you build it into your budget and as to whether you offer full or half-day kindergarten.
Agree? Mark?
Supported by the budget.
I think at this point, if you were trying to go from a half-day program to a full-day program, it would be a huge financial undertaking. Initially, I think half-day probably started out based on child development reasons, but at this point, trying to convert to a full-day program is significant.
Okay. Back to the phones we go. This is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. you know, I heard one of your guests say there'd be a human cry if there were vouchers or some of the policies Betsy DeVos would implement. I would think there would be human cheers if that was implemented, competition, vouchers, et cetera. Where you get the human cries would be from the unions. That's the key right now, I think, to education is competition and vouchers. The charter schools concept is a first step. I think it's got to be taken farther. I a few years ago, I did some research, and I haven't updated it recently, but we spend, I think you mentioned, Evan, that we spend 87% more in New York State than average.
Than the national average, yeah.
Right, right. I did some research maybe 5 years ago or so, and it showed that high school graduation rates, ACT scores, SAT scores in other states are not that much farther behind New York and sometimes equal to New York with much less per student cost. So,
but is the poverty rate the same in those states? I mean, you got to factor a lot of different things, not just money, right?
Well, there's Georgia. You know, some of the states that come to mind: Georgia, Florida,
okay,
etc. But North Carolina. But we have the wealthiest. I think one of the wealthiest poor groups, citizens in the United States, in New York State. A lot of the income, the benefits that show up, isn't shown in income. in what is tabulated. So there's a lot of hidden benefits the poor get here. It doesn't show up that way. A family of three or four with benefits of free medical, subsidized housing, et cetera, they get tremendous in education benefits. They get tremendous hidden income. So I question whether how poor our people are in New York State. They're treated very well.
Thanks for the phone call, John. Let's see what our panelists have to say about that. Why can I not press buttons today? There we go. Thank you, John. Superintendent Linton, what do you think?
I think John makes some very good points. I do. I think the comment that was made about Betsy DeVos's proposed plans or ideas that have been discussed is more about federal reach into states' rights more than about schools. And I think the hue and cry that was mentioned was more in relation to that, that the federal government is overreaching its role in terms of education, which I really don't know if it has a role. And so I think that really was more about states' rights than it was about education. In terms of what impoverished families receive, and because they are impoverished, to me, in terms of being an educator, is it's not about what they're receiving. It's what's happening at home prior to school and what are students learning. That's what prepares them for school. Wealth is a factor in terms of school readiness. So if you're receiving a minimum amount of support for housing or medical care, does that change the way the family functions in terms of preparing their child for school? That's really what education is for. And so students do not come to school at the same starting line. That's just the way it is, based on their backgrounds, oftentimes, not always.
Sure, sure. Assistant Superintendent Green, I think he was poking a little bit at your Betsy DeVos comment. Anything you want to add there?
No, he's right. It wasn't so much as whether there's merit to competition. It's how it's going to be implemented, and top down from the federal government, in my view, isn't the right way to go. Let the states figure it out.
Okay. Superintendent Ward, I think John's also saying that if we are going to spend more than the national average, significantly more, he wants a better return on the investment. That he and test scores is one way to do it. There's a lot of different ways to do it. How should we do it? And you think he's got an argument there?
Well, I think I want to try to answer that question by saying that our schools in the county and in the region are some of the highest performing schools in the state. And I think we need to be very, very proud of that. And we're reminded of that very often. We offer a lot of different programs. Our kids are very successful. We just had a young lady from Gage-Tyli get accepted to Yale, and that doesn't happen everywhere. And so, you know, we need to celebrate the great things that are happening. And there's a lot to be said for public education. And many of us belong to a campaign or have been involved in a campaign around Act for Education. There's a great website out there. You'll see lots of public education stories coming from each of our districts in terms of the great things that are happening in our schools with our kids that I think say a lot. You know, we often get tied up in conversation around assessments, state assessments, and performance. And I will say that the level of competition for me, I'm always competing with my West Side colleagues, and I compete with my East Side colleagues. I don't say that publicly very often, but I am today, and that is we always want to be better. We always want to reach those high achievement levels that each of us aspire to have because it's what's best for kids. We want our kids to be successful. So there are other ways to measure how our school districts are doing. One certainly are those state assessments that we look at and that we're measured on by the state, but we also need to look at social and emotional wellness, health and wellness. We need to look at our kids being happy and wanting to come into school and want to have that love for learning that becomes a lifelong aspect for each of our kids to graduate. And then, you know, we look at, you know, how do our kids make out after graduation? Now, that could be a career track, vocational, career and technical education programs, as well as college readiness. So there's lots of factors that go into that we all look at. But unfortunately, what's public is how we're doing on those state assessments.
On Twitter, Andrew writes and says, we should point out clearly that a school tax cap is the lesser of 2% or calculated inflation. Is that correct, Dave?
Yes.
Okay, so the highest a school tax cap. It caps at 2%. Correct.
That's incorrect.
That's incorrect.
That could go. You could have a tax levy limit higher. Yes.
You could.
Than 2%. Yeah.
Without needing a supermajority.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So, but do we often see that?
Not lately.
Yeah.
When the tax cap was first implemented, there were instances of that. Our own district experienced that. And there's something called carryover that can help in the succeeding. If you don't use all of your tax levy limit in 1 year, you can carry over some of that into a following year, in the following year.
Okay. Rich in Rochester, next on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
I want to make one point, then I want to talk about competition. My point is about SAT and ACT scores. Those are misleading stats because they don't talk to the percentage of students within a state that takes those tests. New York State has for the most part, has a higher percentage of students taking these standardized tests than a lot of other states. So when you were to say 24%, somebody's averaging a score of 24.5, what are you talking about when it comes to the percentage of students? And another thing is I keep hearing about competition, and to my thinking, competition is about, when you talk about private industry, it's about the company winning. No one has explained to me how the children are going to win if you have students competing to get higher scores, so they have this ability to move their students around and accept and not accept students based on the scoring of the student. I don't see where competition is going to help the students if the schools aren't forced, number one, to keep students not based on what they score, but say the area they're in. With school choice with students also comes the school being able to choose the student too. And that's my big problem with both of those things.
All right, Rich, thanks for the phone call.
School choice.
Thank you, Rich. Superintendent Ward talked about competition. Go ahead. Why don't you respond to some of what he had to say there?
Yeah, in terms of competition, my first and foremost is we want to improve academic achievement. We want every child to be successful. And, you know, that takes a lot of work. It's looking at instructional practices, aligned curriculum to the standards. There's lots of things that go into that. So, you know, I'm always raising the bar higher and higher in terms of, you know, we want 100% graduation rates. We want 100% of our students to achieve at the highest level that they're capable of achieving. I think that to me is the competition piece. I think my worry, you know, in terms of competition is we want to look at public education. And I always use this analogy. It sounds rather odd, but I can go to Wegmans and I can pick up a bunch of grapes. Oftentimes, not to say that I do this, but there are some people that pick up that bunch of grapes and they'll pick off the ones that are a little squishy or they're a little dried up or they don't look like they're the same color. In public education, when that bunch of grapes, and I'm referring to our students, we open our doors to all of those grapes. We don't pick off the dry ones or the discolored ones or any of that. We accept all of our children and we level the playing field for all of our children, and we're committed to educating every child that comes into our public schools in hopes of making sure that they're successful when they graduate from high school.
Okay. Craig emails the program and says, in Penfield High School a few years ago, passed a, and again, I can't verify, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he's saying an $81 million bond to upgrade facilities and athletic fields. We now have a state-of-the-art college-level athletic facility. Keep in mind that the school budget makes up at least 3/4 of my tax bill. Does this extravagant spending program give us better grades for our students? It seems crazy that every high school feels they need this level of spending for athletics. So that's from Craig. He's taking us in the direction of whether, you know, what we pay for school, how much pressure is there for sports and for extras? Superintendent Linton, is there pressure for that?
I think Kim was alluding to it, that when students come to school, we're educating the whole child. And in East Rochester, 76% of our students participate in extracurriculars. That's not just athletics. That's music, the arts.
Yep.
So 76% of students. Some students come to school because they are able to participate in extracurricular activities. So I think extracurricular activities are an important part of school. In terms of the state of the art, it goes to a public vote. That's the process. So the additional bond that the Penfield had passed that Craig was referring to, went to a public vote. That's the process. It's in addition to the budget, the regular school budget. So I think extracurriculars are very important in terms of facilities. I think that's a district-by-district basis based on a public vote.
Yeah, and in fact, in this case, it seems like one of the most democratic ways to decide. Voters can decide if this is a priority, and if you feel like you're not comfortable with the way the town that you live in, the school district, spends money or prioritizes, there are probably some options. Do you agree with that, Superintendent Ward?
I do. You know, a lot of what we do around facility management and improvements has a lot to do with a mandate from the State Education Department. We're mandated to do a building condition survey. So every 5 years, we're mandated to make sure that we have a clear understanding of what the needs are around facility improvements. And so we spend a lot of time, and a lot of it has to do with just like your home. You know, you need new roofs, you need to upgrade HVAC, high energy efficiencies around heating and cooling. You have to look at materials that are often become outdated. So when we do a capital project, through voter approval, we are looking a lot at those building condition survey items, and then looking at, while you're in the process of doing that, because there is aid that comes from the state in order to help supplement the cost to the taxpayers to do those additional improvements, and a lot of it has to do with attitude and willingness to come to school, be part of your community, and all that has to do with the richness of the learning environment in which we offer for our public school students.
All right, let me go around the table because we're running out of time, and I want our panelists to let us know, going forward as we go throughout 2017, your wish list to create a more equitable system. Give us that short list that might actually happen, that's within reach. You got the governor's proposals, his comments about not only education aid, how much he thinks it should be versus what the formula should be, updating that. Superintendent Linton from East Rochester, what's on your wish list that would make it more equitable? Not necessarily more money, but more equitable this year.
Yeah, and I don't think it is about more money. I think use the foundation aid formula the way it was intended to be used initially, but also change those parameters in terms of what defines wealth. 0.65 to 2.0 is the current compression range, and I would say that should be changed. That's why I'd let it happen. The other part of the formula was supposed to mean schools would know 2 years in advance what the budget would be. Now, as Kim alluded to, we know approximately 4 weeks in advance if the state budget passes on time.
Okay. Dave?
I would agree with what Dr. Linton has said, but I would also add on the other end, the revenue end, why are schools required to have a supermajority to exceed their tax levy limit when other municipalities are not? This seems discriminatory to me, and it's a further obstacle to dealing with foundation aid fluctuations. Also, kind of in the middle of the revenue and expenditure sides of this equation, if you will, meaningful mandate relief, because when you keep adding mandates, when you constrict how much you can spend and you restrict how much you can take in, there's a cost to all those mandates. And that's just additional pressure, a lot of times outside of the core mission of educating our students.
Okay. Superintendent Ward.
I would say some of the same things. One around foundation aid is just really asking them to take a really comprehensive look at the formula and making sure that they're using those up-to-date calculations and values around our changing demographics statewide around poverty. Look at the property tax cap levy. I think some of the advocacy is just make it a tax cap levy of 2%, which is what many of us feel if we stay within those parameters, we can balance our budgets and have and sustain programs that are best for kids. And around that is the mandate relief. When the property tax cap levy limit was approved by our local legislators, some of that was to go along with some mandate relief, unfunded mandates. And so I would ask that they continue to look at that along with our foundation aid formula.
And Celine on Twitter wanted to know why the state is still using those outdated numbers, almost 20 years old, for poverty. Nobody here can give a perfect answer for that, but everybody agrees it's time to get updated as much as we possibly can. The governor and his staff has indicated that they think so too, so we'll see if that happens this year. And we'll certainly keep you posted. I want to say that the people represented in studio and the district represented in studio are at the top of the list for districts that usually say yes when we call. And we appreciate that very, very much. That doesn't mean that every district who's not here today doesn't care, not at all. Some people are legitimately busy, but we often try to reach around to different districts and kind of bring a diversity of voices. But there are certain districts that say yes pretty quickly. And I just want to thank Mark Linton at East Rochester for being one of those guys. Thank you, Mark. Nice having you here.
Thank you, Evan.
And Dave Green, Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Operations at ER. Thank you as well, Dave.
Thank you.
And Kimberly Ward, Superintendent of Gates Charlie Central School District. Always appreciate the conversation.
Thank you, Evan.
Danny Wegman, Ann Kress, and Vinny Esposito from the state or from the Regional Economic Development Council coming in next. Stay with us.